Bats, brook trout, migratory birds, each has its own special needs for thriving.
If we got out in there, you'd have areas of grasses and some ferns and some other pockets of like goldenrod. And those are the places that they like to seek out to build a nest.
I'm Carol Holsapel. This week on the Allegheny Front, we're looking back at our series, Wild PA, and what people are doing to restore wildlife habitat after development and industry.
You're really getting down to almost less than $2,000 an acre, which may be a lot of money to you and I, but when you're talking about multi-million dollar operations, it's not really very much.
Because let's face it, our lives are enriched by a healthy ecosystem with plenty of fish in the streams.
Next thing you know, boom, a bar of gold just rolls up and annihilates your fly. Yeah, it's pretty intense.
Stories about making room for wildlife on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. In 1984, Congress created the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, and it now supports conservation work with grants in all 50 states and in U.S. territories. A relatively new initiative is underway in western Pennsylvania. It's a business plan to restore healthy forests and freshwater habitat in key areas of the region by working with private and public partners. It's funded by the Richard King Mellon Foundation, which we should say also supports the Allegheny Front. To find out more about the plan, I talked with Amanda Basso, director of the Northeastern Regional Office. How are we doing as a region on conservation? Why is this effort, this plan, needed?
So we began working on the plan, I think, 4 years ago. The region in general, Western Pennsylvania in particular, but also really the Central Appalachian region, is hugely biologically diverse. It's the terminus of the last glacial extent, which means that it has more biodiversity really than places north of it do because of the impact of the glaciers. So it has, you know, incredibly rich and diverse salamander populations, for example, and freshwater mussel populations. And in the mid-Atlantic, it's really the healthiest, strongest populations of eastern brook trout, which is a species that's representative of the health of our cold water streams and a, you know, super popular sport fishing fish as well. So it's just, it's a really important area where we've been trying to actually put together a partnership for quite some time.
So what is the strategy? Give us an overview.
Well, the approach we took was that we knew that we wanted to focus on healthy forest systems and healthy freshwater systems. And so we identified a handful of species that, through talking to experts and local folks on the ground in western Pennsylvania, species that if they were there, you could be pretty sure that the forest system was healthy or the freshwater system was healthy. And so the suite of species we came up with included, on the forest side, American woodcock and golden-winged warbler, which are two species that really specialize in young forest habitat and shrublands habitat. The black-throated blue warbler, which is kind of a bird that specializes in healthy middle-aged forests. And then the cerulean warbler, which really needs a mature forest with some diversity of habitat within that mature forest. On the freshwater side, we looked at eastern brook trout, which I mentioned earlier. Eastern brook trout like a really clean, cold, fast-moving stream, and that's a healthy stream that's going to meet the needs of a lot of different species. So they represent a healthy, kind of smaller headwater stream. And then eastern hellbender, they like bigger water bodies, but they also need clean water and big boulders to hide under. Again, good indicators of water quality and a healthy stream system. And then freshwater mussels, which really are indicators of good water quality, but also each different species of mussel has a host fish species that moves its spat. And so in order to have a diverse and rich population of freshwater mussels, you also have to have a diverse population of fish. So it's a really good indicator of whether you've got a healthy system that's got a lot of different kinds of fish. So those were for the freshwater system. And then we also identified the Louisiana water thrush, which is a bird that really occupies the streamside forest habitat as a species that would make the connection between the upland healthy forest and the aquatic system. So those were the species that we identified that if we had those, there was a pretty good chance that the system was healthy. And then what we did was we mapped where there was good habitat for these species, where there was habitat that had good potential to be quality habitat for these species, but where there might be some threats that were at play that were limiting the success of the species right now. And so we mapped all of that out, and then we identified sort of what we felt were the best opportunities to invest grant funding on the ground, where there were grantees that were active and had the capacity to get work on the ground.
Yeah, these I think there are 11 geographical areas within Western Pennsylvania where the restoration work will happen. Can you talk a little bit about the threats part for why there needs to be a restoration project?
Sure. Lots of different things going on the landscape for a long time. We looked at land use change, so where development has fragmented forest systems in particular, where polluted runoff from city streets, from agriculture, from roads, dirt and gravel roads even, has degraded water quality. There's several different strategies to improve eastern brook trout populations. A lot of these brook trout populations that are still healthy are isolated from one another. They're not able to bolster their genetic population because they can't find each other because of dams, failing culverts, and in some cases, warm water or acidic water can actually be a barrier for the fish to pass. And so we invest in projects that replace failing culverts. In some cases, we will invest in projects that remove unwanted derelict dams. Western Pennsylvania has tremendous forests. It has really healthy blocks of forest, which is really important. And so we looked at opportunities to reconnect blocks of forest with wildlife corridors and just more intentional management. We looked at historic mining activities on the land and where were there opportunities to engage in restoration of abandoned mine lands, to restore acid mine drainage on the aquatic habitat side. So really the broad swath of activities going on the land that impact water and forest health.
I was going to ask, why this particular investment in habitat restoration and species conservation is important to Western Pennsylvania and then also in a larger scale.
So you're really asking, well, why I care about conservation, right?
I guess it's an obvious question, but when are you trying to sell this kind of an idea to funders, but also to just sort of the general population or to farmers who have to, make sort of changes or improvements on the way they're doing things, or, stakeholders? What do you say?
I think that actually is a really good question. And we have a lot of great partners actually now working with us. Last year, we rolled out something we called the Central Appalachian Habitat Stewardship Program, which is how we're investing in this business plan in Western Pennsylvania. And the American Forest Foundation, for example, is one of our partners who's helping to fund that program. They are an organization that works exclusively with family woodland owners, family non-industrial forests. And they've done a lot of survey work with that community about what they care about. And they definitely, have an economic interest in managing a forest so that they can meet their long-term economic goals for the land. But they very much value the wildlife in that forest. So it's really an opportunity when we talk to family woodland owners, what our grantees are talking about is, what do you value about your land and how can we help you meet your goals for your land? And most times their goals are actually consistent with our mission and our goals as stated in this business plan. Farmers are the same way. We've been working in this region for a long time in the Chesapeake Bay portion of the Western Pennsylvania region. And we learned a decade ago that farmers in this region really care about eastern brook trout. And actually, a lot of them will talk about how they remember when they used to have eastern brook trout on their land and that they used to like to fish in their favorite fishing hole and that they really like to have eastern brook trout back. And talking to a farmer about eastern brook trout is a much more productive conversation than talking to them about the water quality in the Chesapeake Bay. Wildlife is actually the language that resonates with a lot of private landowners, isn't it? And is a really productive way to start a conversation. But we're always starting the conversation with, what are your goals for your land and what kind of conservation might be complementary and even help you meet those goals?
Well, thank you so much for talking with me. I appreciate it.
You bet.
Amanda Basso is director of the Northeastern Regional Office of the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation. Their new round of funding announced last month will invest $1.4 million to restore habitat for forest birds, brook trout, and hellbender salamanders. Our interview kicked off a series of wildlife stories about creating space for trout and other species. We'll hear some of them next. I'm Carol Holzapfel. This is the Allegheny Front. For people searching for the best fly fishing spots to catch wild trout in the U.S., central Pennsylvania still makes the top 10 lists. That's despite historical pollution and runoff from agriculture and development. For our series, Wild PA, the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant headed to the region in August to find out how people there are working to keep these premier streams clean.
It's just before sunset, and 27-year-old Matt Kowalczyk is standing in the river near the bank of Penn's Creek in central Pennsylvania, not far from State College. He's a fly fishing guide and chooses a lure meant to catch wild trout.
We're going to see if we can get one to eat a stonefly. It's hard to pass up a big meal.
Kowalczyk attaches the fly to his line and walks deeper into the center of the fast-moving creek. He casts upstream. His line doesn't dance through the air like in a river runs through it, but his lure lands lightly on the water and floats down a ways. No bites, so he pulls it out and casts upstream again.
And you do it again, and you do it again, and you do it again, and you do it again. The next thing you know, boom, a bar of gold just rolls up and annihilates your fly. Yeah, it's pretty intense. It gets the adrenaline pumping.
Kowalczyk considered moving to Montana or Colorado after college, but he loves it here.
In the middle of Pennsylvania, mountains all around you, watching the bald eagles chase the osprey for the trout.
In high summer, the water is still cool, maybe 60 degrees, and remains that temperature because it's fed by cold springs and mountain creeks. Unlike some streams, the state doesn't stock Penn's Creek with trout.
It doesn't need it. This stream is Class A wild trout water, meaning that it has a naturally sustaining population of fish that does not need us to do anything about. If you come here in October and November, you can walk the stream and find the fish actively spawning, and that is cool to see.
One reason the trout do well here, abundant food. When I visited, Kowalczyk was just finishing up with the angling frenzy around the hatch of green drake and especially large mayfly.
And that's a huge draw. That is the big hatch here. That's the reason everyone comes to fish, the green drake. It's actually pretty insane.
Even closer to State College in nearby Spring Creek, a spill of cyanide at Penn State in the 1950s wiped out the green drake population. The mayflies have never recovered there. Now, the Clean Water Act protects these creeks from large-scale chemical dumping. It's led to improvements in sewage treatment and stormwater management, and wild trout populations have rebounded. There's usually not one big pollution source anymore. Today, it's more like death by a thousand cuts. Urbanization and growth in State College, like rooftops, roads, and parking lots, cause runoff and pollution in Spring Creek. In the more rural Penns Creek watershed, it's the farms. 80% of the land here is in agriculture, corn, soy, and dairy.
This was a cow pasture, and that was a cow pasture.
David Martinick is working with the Penns Valley Conservation Association, a local nonprofit, to restore the stream bed at his longtime family farm. He points to the high bank on the far side of the creek where a backhoe is moving hemlock logs brought in for a restoration project.
And we took the cattle off. The non-native invasive species just grew up and just choked everything out.
Martinick wanted to encourage native wildlife, woodcock and songbirds here, but he got inundated with invasives instead, like autumn olive and Chinese honeysuckle.
And what happens when you start choking out the native plants and the grasses, the little seeds and the little things that the little birds and that, they leave.
The Conservation Association's Lyle Sherwin, who leads many area landowners on projects like this, says the bare soil of the cow pastures left these stream banks without tree roots for structure.
They're falling into the stream. Massive erosion.
You can see silt from the eroding bank filling up the shallow stream here. Sherwin says this limestone bed is spawning ground for trout, and the sediment literally smothers their eggs. That's why they're building what's basically a reinforced wall of logs along the stream.
It simulates an eroded bank that has structure and function to it, but it's a built bank. It's a stable bank.
Sherwin has worked on 14 improvement projects like this in recent years and says the more they do, the more landowners want to try it.
It's sort of keeping up with the Joneses. Oh, wait a minute, they did that stream project and it worked for them and they seem happy with it.
Many of these projects get funding through a USDA program that's proposed to be cut in the House version of the 2018 Farm Bill. Sherwin hopes funding doesn't dry up because the more stream restoration, the better for the wild brown trout in Penn's Creek and for the anglers who pour in to catch them. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
The Trump administration says it doesn't know how many streams would go unprotected if its latest environmental rollback goes into effect.
So that's not true at all. At least 18% of streams nationwide are not going to be covered by the Trump rule.
On the latest episode of our Trump on Earth podcast, the replacement for the Waters of the U.S. rule and what it means for drinking water and wildlife habitat. That's at trumponearth.org or wherever you listen to podcasts. Nearly 1,800 acres of state-owned forest in Pennsylvania have been cleared for gas drilling over the last decade. And that's wiped out habitat for many native species. For our Wild PA series earlier this year, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier checked in with researchers who are trying to bring some of it back.
Kelly Sitch is an ecologist with the Pennsylvania Department of Conservation and Natural Resources. And right now, he's walking in a clearing deep in the Tyodotten State Forest in north central Pennsylvania. We're surrounded by wildflowers and tall grasses in what is essentially an outdoor laboratory.
Here's a mix that was all native grasses and wildflowers. As you can see right now, this appears to be solid wild bergamot.
Sitch and a group of scientists have divvied up this clearing into dozens of small plots, each planted with different species. The one we're standing next to was planted with wild bergamot. It's a native species with light purple flowers that look like pom-poms. Butterflies and bees hover over these chest-high flowers on this warm summer morning.
This is only a 13 by 13 foot square, but to a bumblebee, this is a fantastic ecosystem right here. So it wouldn't take a very large portion of a well pad edge to provide a lot of ecosystem benefits.
DCNR has leased over 100,000 acres of state forest to the gas industry for fracking in the Marcellus Shale. Here in the Tyodotten, the industry has cut down around 1,000 acres of forest to make way for well pads, pipelines, and compressor stations. Sitch says most of this land won't be grown back as forests, at least not for decades.
But there's a lot of areas around the edge of the well pad that have been cleared, or perhaps areas that were used to store water trucks or fracking equipment that's no longer necessary when it's just in production.
And it's these areas, around the edges of gas development, that Sitch and his colleagues like Patrick Drohan want to resuscitate. Drohan, a soil scientist at Penn State, says the problem isn't just that the forest has been cut down. To build a well pad, companies use heavy equipment to compact the ground underneath.
Most of the time, what's done for these types of operations is they compact to what's called no movement. And that standard is similar when you're building a parking lot. It's similar to when you're building a shale gas pad.
And that's not good for plants to grow in. Compacted soil has fewer pores to store water or gases that a plant needs to survive.
So in this case, what we're trying to do is alleviate deep compaction. And to do that, you need to use big equipment to rip the soil.
The team brought in a bulldozer with a special attachment on it to cut into the compacted soil. Basically, they tilled the ground to varying depths to see which depth worked best. One row at the far end of the plot has not been loosened at all. Not surprisingly, it's doing worse than the other rows.
That far row is much less drought tolerant than the other three rows. And we're seeing a lot more non-native invasive species that can still tolerate that very dry soil.
The goal, Sitch says, is to give gas companies step-by-step instructions for repairing and replanting the borders of their well pads, pipelines, and other construction areas. He doesn't think cost should be a problem for most companies.
You're really getting down to almost less than $2,000 an acre, which may be a lot of money to you and I, but when you're talking about multi-million dollar operations over many sites, it's not really very much of a money commitment.
For now, the agency isn't proposing to make any of these methods mandatory. And so far, Sitch says, gas companies have been receptive to the group's ideas. The Tyodotten State Forest is 150,000 acres. Sitch says even if they can only restore a few hundred of these, that would be worth it.
If we're creating habitat for insects, for songbirds, butterflies and moths, native plants, that's a great deal of real estate.
Bringing back some of the forest is better than none at all. Yeah. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
Yeah, it's a swallowtail, a native butterfly.
Reed Frazier also reported on Pennsylvania's importance as a breeding ground for over 100 species of migratory birds. Many of them are songbirds, which fill forests with their chatter. But some of these species are in decline, and the state is trying to create more habitat to help them. As Reed explains, sometimes that means using an age-old tool that reshapes forests. Fire.
In a clearing in the Allegheny Mountains, 25 men in fire-resistant gear gather in a circle.
Today, did everybody get a hold of a map?
Ben Jones is in charge of the Pennsylvania Game Commission's prescribed fire program. He's telling these men, mostly Game Commission officers with special fire training, about today's controlled burn. Jones begins with a weather report, some safety tips, and tells them what they're trying to accomplish today.
Well, this is part of the area that was heavily hit by gypsy moth around 2008, 2009, with a lot of oak mortality. We're trying to tip that balance back to the oak forest that it was before gypsy moth.
The state's had this prescribed fire program for about a decade to maintain different kinds of habitat across the Game Commission's 1.5 million acres of public game lands. Today's fire will cover a 500-acre strip of it in Center County. Jones takes a crew about 1.5 miles down a dirt road into the forest. At the end, he walks down a path.
Fire has been a part of these habitats for thousands of years. Since the glaciers retreated, fires have been burning through these habitats for, pushing 10,000 years.
Some of these fires were set by Native Americans to promote certain types of berry crops or improve hunting grounds. He says this is basically what the Game Commission is doing today.
After these fires, this will be a great place to come in and turkey hunt just next week.
Jones and his team pick a spot to start the fire, where the wind will keep it from spreading too fast once it's set. Gage Meyer, a Game Commission officer from Cameron County, walks around with a large metal can with a spray nozzle attached at the end.
It's a mixture of diesel fuel and gasoline. It's 4-to-1. It's not too potent, but it does the job.
Meyer ignites a clump of leaves that have been doused with the fuel. From there, he and another crew member spray the fuel in a straight line along the path. The fire quickly spreads. The fire burns knee high, turning leaves on the ground black. A wall of heat pulses off the forest floor. This fire will benefit oak trees and wild turkeys, but it'll also create a home for some rare or threatened songbirds. A few miles away, Jeff Larkin, a biologist at Indiana University of Pennsylvania, walks along a flat ridgetop dotted with small trees.
Where these guys live, right? These are
pitch pine. Fire came through relatively thick bark.
This forest was burned 2 years ago. There are still scorch marks on some stumps, but small woody plants are quickly taking over the forest floor. Larkin says these fires will help create habitat for some birds that don't need a deep forest to raise their young in.
There are a few species that populations have been plummeting for quite a bit longer, and therefore they're kind of on the conservation radar screen, if you will.
One of the most threatened species is the golden-winged warbler. It's a migratory bird that's currently being considered for protection under the Endangered Species Act. Once abundant, its population has declined by two-thirds since the 1960s. Several states and the federal government are spending millions to keep the species from going extinct. It's a tiny gray bird with splashes of brilliant yellow on its head and wings that give the bird its name. The golden-winged warbler winters in parts of Central and South America that are rapidly being deforested, and then it migrates to North America in the spring, which is pretty amazing for a creature that weighs only 9 grams.
We're talking about like the weight of a quarter or a nickel? Not very much, and you can think about that critter trying to get across the Gulf of Mexico and then find its way back to its breeding grounds.
Those breeding grounds are young forests, like those being created by controlled burns. The birds don't nest high in the trees, but closer to the ground.
Because they got kids that can barely fly. They're trying not to be eaten by hawks and snakes and chipmunks and everything else that wants to eat a songbird. And they're also trying to make sure that there's ample amounts of food.
But that perfect young forest is rare in Pennsylvania. Why? Larkin takes me to another nearby site for the answer. It was burned a couple of years ago, but small trees and shrubs are growing back. A century ago, Larkin says, this field would have probably been clear-cut, like the rest of Pennsylvania's forests.
We could all go back in our time machines before any of us were around, think about the massive landscape-scale clearing of our forests that occurred. When that happened, all of our forests, basically their age became reset.
So most forests in the state is about 100 years old. Larkin says this is bad, not just for golden-winged warblers, but for other species that evolved to survive in specific types of forests or wetlands.
Think about our forests before that happened. The thousands of years of structural complexity that developed.
That complexity is in evidence at this site that was burned a few years ago. A few lone hickory trees stand in a sea of blackberry bushes and oak and maple saplings.
Here's a great example of what we call the golden-winged warbler nesting habitat. If we got out in there, you'd have areas of some grasses and some ferns and some other pockets of like goldenrod. And those are the places that they like to seek out to build a nest and to raise their young.
And with any luck, golden-winged warblers will be able to raise their young here this summer. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
All of the wildlife stories you just heard from our Wild PA series, and many more from the past year, can be found on our website, alleghenyfront.org/wildpa. Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter, at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show. I'm Kara Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation.